two guys who were in Xerxes' cabinet, in his organization, the king's organization. Their responsibility, chief responsibility, was to guard the gate of the king. And lo and behold, they were so upset with the king that they decided that they were going to make a plot to kill the king. Now, for some reason, and we don't know the reason why, they decide that they are going to include Mordecai in the information. Mordecai either hears of it or is asked to be part of it. In some way, form, or fashion, Mordecai hears the plot from these two men who want Xerxes killed. Mordecai sends word to Esther. Esther goes to her husband, the king, and tells the king, and lo and behold, the king goes and investigates the situation and finds out it to be true. He has the two men in his organization hung on gallows. Now he's got two places in his organization that are empty. He's got to fill the two spots. There's a young man who is in that organization. Actually, he's not a young man. He's already got several sons. And his name is Haman, and he is elevated to the position of prime minister in the Persian organization. Well, Xerxes goes on and does something else. He doesn't put another person in the organization. He takes the two jobs, he turns them into one job, and then lo and behold, he takes that one job and he puts that person in between him, the king, and the seven princesses that have always been at the king's beck and call and also always had the ability just to walk into the king anytime and say, "King, we need to talk about this. This is going on in our government. This is going on here in the city. This is going on over in Ethiopia. This is going on here in Egypt. This is going on over in Syria. We need to talk about this. Here's something we think you should do." They had unaltered, unhandicapped, unbarricaded access to the king at any time. But these are those same seven men that when Vashti, the king's wife, refused to come and show herself at the end of the banquet on the seventh day of that wonderful banquet that the king had presented to all the men and his nobles. These are the same seven men who said, "Listen, if your wife does that to you, king, our wives will do that to us." And lo and behold, throughout the entire kingdom, all the women, oh, forbid, will rise up against their husbands and take control of their households and put the men down lower than they are. You can't do this. You cannot allow Vashti to ignore your order. You, king, if you think that she'll do this to you, this will happen in our households too. Of course, Xerxes is drunk, and so are the princesses. So they suggest to the king that he put out an edict that puts Vashti away and she will no longer be the queen, even though she is pregnant with Xerxes' son, who's Artaxerxes, who will become king when Xerxes dies, and also sends out an edict to all of the land, all over the 127 provinces, that says the husband will be the head of the house. I'm not even going to respond. That'll get me in trouble. Well, when Xerxes comes to his senses, he realizes that he cannot go and see his beautiful queen any longer, and she cannot come to him because the law of the Medes and the Persians cannot be broken. So Xerxes has now taken Haman and has elevated him above those seven princesses and put a barrier so they can no longer come at any time and have access to him at any time whatsoever they desire. Now they have to go through Haman, the prime minister. So Xerxes put this buffer in between him and these seven princesses who had advised him poorly. And in that edict of putting Haman as prime minister, he also said in the edict that everyone will bow to Haman when he comes and goes in homage, the word homage meaning worship. Haman has it all. He is the prime minister. He is second in command, control of the whole entire Persian Empire. What could be better than that? And lo and behold, Mordecai, a faithful, faithful Jew who will worship no one but the Lord God, will not bow down and pay homage to Haman, and it just drives Haman crazy. Now, can you imagine? Everything in your life is going just perfect and wonderful except for one small, tiny little thing. Haman's in control of the empire that stretches all the way from India to Spain to Africa to Ethiopia to Egypt to Turkey to Syria to Babylon. Every place to Germany, every place is in the world that they can get to, even to what we call Britain now. Haman is second in control of it, can do what he pleases with it. And we got one little Jew that will not bow to him. One Jewish man, for some reason, and it just gets in Haman's craw, and he just is so OCD over it that he... You know what OCD is? Obsessive compulsive about Haman. Folks, you got to realize everybody has a little thorn in their flesh. Everybody. There's just one little thing that just keeps pricking you to keep you in line. Well, Haman is so bothered that he decides he's not going to attack just Mordecai. He's going to attack Mordecai's people. And so, according to the last lesson, Haman doesn't know exactly the right time to go and speak to the king about this. So he has the men come in. They start casting what they call pur, P-U-R. That's casting of dice for the purpose of deciding and seeing whether it is the right day to approach the king. And for one full year, the dice keep coming up saying, nope, not today. Next day, nope, not today. Finally, they come up in the 12th month. Almost 354 days have passed, and it comes up, yes, today's the day. And Haman goes into the king and says, King, I want to tell you about these Jews. I want to tell you what they're doing. And I think we need to kill them all. I would like to put out an edict, and I will pay you, king, 10,000 talents of gold if you will allow me to do it and put it into your treasury. And the king says, nah, keep the money. The money's yours. The people are to you. Do what you want to do with them. You're second in command. You can do it. Make the edict. In fact, Haman, here's my signet ring. Go ahead and have it all written up and stamp it with my signet ring as if it's from me and send the edict out. And so on, beginning of the next year on Nisan, that happened in the 12th month, but in the beginning of the next year on Nisan the 13th of 473 BC, Haman has all the different scribes come in every single language of every people in the Persian Empire. At that time, they receive an edict in their language. The Ethiopians in Ethiopian, the Egyptians in whatever language that they are hearing it in, the Syrians in their language, over the Germanic people in their language, and the Macedonian people in their language. They're hearing it in their language, and the edict is written. They're all stamped in the wax with the seal. And lo and behold, the couriers go out with it on that 13th day of Nisan. And the decree says that on the 12th month of the year, that's Adar the 13th, 11 months and one day after the edict goes out, that the order is to be fulfilled. And here's the order. Every single Jew of Jewish descendant anywhere in the kingdom is to be annihilated. Now, I want you to think about the ramifications of that. Let's say over in Ethiopia, there is an Ethiopian man who's married a Jewish woman, and they have half-Jewish children. Is his wife going to be killed from the edict? Absolutely. What about the children? Absolutely. Let's say there is what we would call an Italian man over in the Italy area. It's not quite called that yet. It's the Roman areas during this time. And it's already been, Romulus has already done his thing in the Roman area, but still under Persian control. And a Jewish man has married what we'd call a Roman woman. And they've had children. Will the husband be killed? Absolutely. What about the children? Absolutely. Lo and behold, throughout the entire kingdom, this is going to cause a problem. Now, we don't think about how big and huge this is. This is like, think about this like an hourglass or a minute glass, like we do the egg boiler glass, where the sand's in the top, and then it comes to this V point, and then from there it spreads out again. This is a point in Israel's history. It's like at that little V point. And if a little moisture happens, condensation happens to get through the glass, when that little blob of sand gets to the V point, nothing else continues. There can be sand above it that will not move and sand below it, and the history of time stops in that hourglass or minute glass. This is where we are. Everything is funneling down because every single Jew is going to die at the hands of the Persian Empire people on the 13th day of the 12th month, that's the month of Adar, if this edict stays in place. Now, for me, that causes great turmoil in my thinking and also shows the providence of God. Because you see, almost 100 years later, Jeremiah had been called out by the Lord, and Jeremiah chapter 1 through chapter 28, everything in that is the oracles of the Lord saying to Jeremiah, say this to these people, say this to these people, say this to these people, and don't miss one word. The Lord is telling him word for word what to say. And in chapters 33 through the end of Jeremiah 52, the Lord is saying, Jeremiah, tell this to the people, tell this to the people, tell this to the people. But right in between there, in Jeremiah 29 through 31, 32, that is a private conversation with Jeremiah and the Lord. You will see nothing in those chapters where the Lord says, Jeremiah, tell the people this. No, this is all just between Jeremiah and the Lord, because Jeremiah said, listen, Lord, I've told all these things to these people. Are my people? What is going to happen to my people? And in those passages, the Lord lays out prophecies about what's going to happen to Israel, Jeremiah's people. And he even says, Jeremiah, let me tell you how true this is. Let me tell you how much promises I'm telling you this is going to happen. Let me tell you, it's going to happen, because if Jeremiah, if you can count the stars, I will not fulfill my promises for the Jews. Jeremiah, if you can count the sands on the seashore and tell me an accurate number of how many are there, I will not fulfill these promises. In other words, to Jeremiah, he's saying these promises are going to take place. But lo and behold, we're 100 years later, and the Jews, all the Jews in the world are fixing to be annihilated. How can God's promises be fulfilled? The promise of a Savior coming. Jesus hasn't come yet. He's got to come from these people. We are at that place in the clock where if something gets stuck and the Jews are annihilated, the whole rest of the promises of God are not going to happen. And you and I would not be in this place studying the Word of God if Haman's plot had been fulfilled. We wouldn't be here. Well, Mordecai, on the very first day, the 13th of Nisan, the couriers are going out to all the lands, but they're in Susa, and that's where Mordecai is, and he gets a copy of the edict, and he reads it, and he is mortified. He takes off his clothing that he has. He puts on the clothing of the poorest of the poor, the sackcloth. He covers himself in dirt. He covers himself in sooty ashes, and he goes to the king's gate, and there he sits at the king's gate, just like he does every day, and he mourns, and he grieves. And that picks us up to where we are here in chapter 4, verse 3. And in each and every province where the command and decree of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and wailing, and many lay on sackcloth and ashes. Just like we did in verse 2 before with Mordecai, the entire provinces of the kingdom react to this edict that's been sent out by Haman in the same way. They are mortified. They are mourning. The great distress that comes upon them robs them of their appetite. They too put on sackcloth. They too cover themselves with sooty ashes. They too cover themselves with dirt, which is the way that people in that day and time mourned. And by the way, you have seen it on footage of television clips too, when in the Palestinian era, the Gaza Strip, which is in the news now, whenever Yasser Arafat died, the Palestinian leader, you saw them bowing down on their knees in the dirt and throwing dirt up on above them into the air and having it come down upon them. That is the way that these people mourn. Everybody in the entire nation of Persia are mourning the same way Mordecai did. Verse 4. Then Esther's maidens and her eunuchs came and told her, and the queen writhed in great anguish. They've come and told her about Mordecai. Understand that. She doesn't know about the edict yet. And she sent garments to clothe Mordecai that he might remove his sackcloth from him, but he did not accept them. She was afraid. because you did not go to the king ever unless you were dressed in your finest. You did not go to the king's gate where you might be seen by the king or see the king unless you dressed in your finest. And Mordecai has dressed in the worst things that he could dress in, and he has covered himself in filth and dirt. And Esther is sending clothing so that he can be dressed properly for the place that he is sitting. Then Esther summoned Hathach from the king's eunuch, whom the king had appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was. Hathach is a servant, is a eunuch of Xerxes that had been appointed to take care of Esther and any needs that she had. Esther gets Hathach, she trusts him, and she sends him to Mordecai and says, go find out what's going on. Why is he dressed this way? Why will he not accept the gift of clothing that I'm sending him? What is going on right now? So Hathach went out to Mordecai to the city square in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the exact amount of money that Haman had promised to pay the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. Now, how did Mordecai know about the 10,000 talents? Wasn't that done in private? Wasn't that done just with King Xerxes? Evidently, Haman has come down and he's boasted after the edict's been placed out. Not only that, I even offered 10,000 talents for this of gold for this to happen. And the king says, I could keep it because all of you Jews or all the people are in my control and in my command, as the king said. Verse 8. So he also gave him a copy of the text of the edict, which had been issued to in Susa for their destruction, that he might show Esther and inform her and to order her to go to the king to implore his favor and to plead with him for her people. For her people. So, lo and behold, Mordecai is saying to Hathach, the eunuch, go back and take this text to the queen so she'll know about this edict and tell her you've got to go into your husband the king for the sake of your people. Okay, the cat's out of the bag. Remember, she's not told anybody that she's Jewish, but Mordecai has just told Hathach, a eunuch, a Persian eunuch, to go back to Esther and tell her, this is to save your people, your people. So the cat's out of the bag. The people are going to know that she is Jewish, even though she's queen. And Hathach came back and related Mordecai's word to Esther. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and ordered him to reply to Mordecai. All the king's servants and all the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king into the inner court who is not summoned, he has but one law, and that he be put to death. Unless the king holds out to him the golden scepter so that he may live. And I have not been summoned to come to the king for these 30 days. And they related Esther's words to Mordecai. Esther says, through Hathach to Mordecai, no woman, no man can go to the inner court of the king unless they are summoned. To even step to the door of the threshold of the inner court where the king's throne is and not be summoned by the scepter means death, immediate death. Esther says, I can't go. I can't go. It's the law of the Medes and Persians. Only those who have been summoned. And I have not been summoned for 30 days to go even see the king. She has not seen her king, her husband, for 30 days. What does Mordecai say? Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. Esther, Hadassah. Hadassah is her Jewish name. Esther is her queen name. It means Venus, the beauty of Venus. Don't think that just because you're a queen, you're going to get out of this because you are a Jew and they will find you and they will kill you too because you are a Jew. But I'm the queen. No, it doesn't matter. You're a Jew. The edict of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be broken, is for all the Jews to be killed. Why can't the king break that? He couldn't even break the edict, not allowing Vashti to ever be seen by him again, because it was the law of the Medes and the Persians. The law was, once the edict was in place, it could not be changed even by the king who made the edict. Haman has placed an edict out on the king's signature. How can this king change anything with even Esther going to speak to him? What the king will have to do, just a little speed ahead, the king will have to issue some sort of edict that clashes with the other edict to render it useless and not viable. But the king can't change the first edict, so he has to do something super special. Well, he goes on, verse 14 says, "For if you remain silent, Esther, at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish." Listen, that is a threat from Mordecai. That's a threat from Mordecai. If you do not arise and do what I am asking you to do, the Jews, we are going to survive. But you and your father's house, remember there's nobody left in father's house. Esther's the last. Father's dead. Mother's dead. Esther's an orphan. She's come to live with Mordecai. You and your father's house will die because you're the queen in the palace. In other words, Mordecai is saying, if you don't do something to talk to the king, to get him to change or do something about this edict, this Persian Empire is going to be overrun. Now, I have problems with that because you have to remember, the Persians are going to be overrun by the Greeks. That prophecy's already happened. Are they going to come early? We never know. Never know. But you have to remember, too, that the Persians could, someone from within the Persian government could rise over Xerxes and take him over from within the government. So probably the Persian Empire would continue. But Mordecai is saying, if you don't do something, it will be done and you will die. Now, Esther has just said, I can't go because if the king doesn't hold out his scepter to me, I'll die. And Mordecai says, if you don't go, you're going to die anyway. What's your options? They don't look really good right now. Well, he says, and who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this? Who knows? 5 years ago, God may have made all the arrangements so that you, Esther, are the queen for just this point in time on the clock. And without you, Esther, without you, a woman, it seems like you'd need a man, don't you? But in this time, it's a woman is going to be the one who gets the man to do what needs to be done. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai. Esther has heard the message. She's going to die anyway, one way or another, unless something miraculous happens. He says, go assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa and fast for me. Now, that's something that the Jews picked up in Egypt. They were never, ever, any place in the Old Testament commanded by the Lord to fast. They picked it up in Egypt when they were there. He says, do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. And I will have my maidens also fast in the same way. It is something they did when great grief came upon them or great mourning happened in their life or whenever someone had died. It says, and thus I will go to the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish. So the clock starts, a 3-day time clock starts, and everyone is to treat her and to act as if she has died with great mourning, robbed of their appetite. Esther's a popular queen. For all the Jews to hear that she is going to go to the king and she has not been summoned, I'm sure the people went, what if he doesn't accept her? If he does not put out the scepter towards her and bring it towards him to nod her in, the doorman will cut her down and she will die. If he allows her to come in and he does this with the scepter, the doorman will cut her down and she will die. Who knows what the Persian king will do? So Mordecai went and did just as Esther had commanded him. Or told him to do. He got all the Jews to pray for her, to mourn her as if she is already dead, and so did the maidens. The same maidens that were probably selected for her by that old, ugly, old eunuch who was in charge of the virgin harem, by the way. Remember his name? His name was Hegai. It meant repulsive. By the way, I forgot to tell you last week, it was in your notes, but the other eunuch who was in charge of the concubine harem. That means once the women went to spend a night with the king, they never came back to the virgin harem again, they went to the concubine harem. And the concubine harem was controlled by a eunuch by the name of Shaagaz. And that name in Hebrew means beardless. And to be beardless in that day and time was the worst shame that could happen. If you remember, David had sent some of his men over to go ask some questions, and they shaved half of their beards and cut their robes off way up above the back end of the people. And they sent word to David, and David says, just stay over where you are till your beards grow back out. That's what a shame of being a beardless man or a man without hair on his face was. And so he controlled, being a eunuch, controlled that harem. Well, it says, now it came about on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's rooms. And the king was sitting on his royal throne in the throne room opposite the entrance of the palace. Esther puts on the best of her best of the best of the best of the best of the best. Just as if she was going to see the people or see the king. She puts on the best that she has, and she steps to the threshold of the door between these two sets of rooms, and she can see the king on his throne on the other end, and she does not know how the king is going to react to her. However, it's okay. Verse 2. And it happened that when the king saw Esther the queen standing in the court, she obtained favor in his sight. And the king extended to Esther the golden scepter which was in his hand. So Esther came near and touched the top of the scepter. This was very important in those days and time. The scepter was extended, brought back, and that meant to come. And it was held out by the king until the person coming in touched the top of the scepter to signify that they were under the authority of the king. And that was the only way for anyone to come into the throne room without being summoned by the king. And therefore, the doorman and all the guards are watching to see what happens with that scepter. They're not interested in the king. They're not interested in the queen. They're interested in what is done with that scepter. They're watching the scepter. It's the baton. It's like the conductor in front of the music, and he's just doing this with the baton. You got it? We as musicians, we don't watch him. We don't watch his arms. We watch the baton to see what it's doing. We're looking for the downbeat. We're looking for the rhythm and the time that's being done with the baton as it's going through the air. And they are looking at the scepter to see what he does with the scepter. Then the king said to her, "Oh, husbands, it doesn't matter how long you've been away from your wives, you know when there's a problem, don't you? What is troubling you, Queen Esther? And what is your request? Even to half the kingdom, it will be given to you. Tell me what is going on. You look all downtrodden. Something is bothering you. Tell me what will make you happy. Even to half my kingdom, I will give it to you." You know, when a woman's troubled, she doesn't want half the kingdom. She just wants to be heard. She's got a message. And what the king is saying here, "I'll give you half the kingdom. It's all yours. I'll put it all under your authority if that will make you happy. Whatever you want to make you happy, I will do what it takes to make you happy, up to half the kingdom." Half the kingdom. And Esther said, "If it pleases the king..." Oh, she's a smart woman. "If it pleases the king, may the king and Haman come this day to the banquet which I have prepared for him." Who's she prepared the banquet for? For the king? Mm-mm. For Haman. She has prepared a banquet for Haman. "King, would you please come with your prime minister to the banquet which I have prepared?" Now, I'm sure the king was very busy that day. He had a lot of phone calls to answer, a lot of emails, a lot of text to dictate to someone to write down. I'm sure he had a lot of things to do sitting on his throne with no princesses around because they can't get to him without going through Haman. And what does the king do? The king said, "Yes, bring Haman quickly so that we may do as Esther desires." That's what she's asking for. So the king and Haman came to the banquet with Esther that Esther had prepared. So Xerxes falls right into Esther's plan. Guys, you taking a clue here? If your wives do not, or girlfriends do not tell you right off the bat what they want, and it looks like a diversionary act is going on, tactic, It is best to fall into her plans. It is always best to fall into her plans. That's at least the way I think about it. And so Haman comes because the king has called for her. Verse 6, it says, "And as they drank their wine, the king said to Esther," oh, he hadn't got it off her mind, his mind. "He has seen her with that downtrodden face." He says, "What is your petition? For it shall be granted unto you. And what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be done." Just, "Esther, we come in here. I've brought Haman. What do you want? What is it that you'd like to have? Even to half your kingdom, I would be glad to give it to you. You can control it. Everything will be wonderful. You are such a wonderful person." Because Xerxes really does love Esther. He would not have done that with his scepter if she had walked straight into the throne room and right in the middle of something important. He cared for her and he loved her, even though she wasn't sure. And so Esther answers and says, "My petition and my request is," and I think she probably paused, "if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and to do what I request, may the king and Haman come to the banquet which I shall prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king says." Oh, that's just one of those wonderful things. Guys, you know how it is. You've asked your wife, "What's wrong, honey?" "Nothing." And so you go on a little longer and you say, "Honey, are you okay? What's wrong with you?" "Nothing." She's going to put it off for another day. Put it off. She doesn't quite know how to ask you yet what she wants to ask. And so for some reason, and I believe it's an intervention of God, causes her to put it off for another day because she needs to do something that makes Haman feel extremely special. "Will you come with Haman tomorrow and drink another banquet," and she asked, "that I will prepare tomorrow?" Then Haman went out that day glad and pleased at heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand up or tremble before him, Haman was filled with anger against Mordecai. There's that thorn in the flesh that everybody has one, and Mordecai is Haman's thorn in the flesh. Haman controlled himself. However, he went to his house, and he sent for his friends and his wife Zeresh. Now listen, he's prime minister. Where is Haman's house? Haman's house is not going to be very far from the king's throne room. Haman's house is going to be with inside the palace somewhere, right around on the corner somewhere. The palace has walls that are 75 feet high at this point in time, according to all the descriptions of the palace that Darius the First, that's Xerxes' dad, built, and Xerxes moved into it as the king. So Haman's gone around the corner. He's gone to his house. He's called his friends. He's called his wife Zeresh, and he is fit to be tied. He has the world by the tail, folks. He has control over the largest empire known in the world at that period of time. He controls everything from one end of it to the other. He can speak and have it done, and he's got one little Jew that is just sticking him. It's like when you walk across the grass and you get one little kookaburra thing right in your foot. You know what I'm talking about? And all of a sudden, you can't do anything without just jerking around because that little sticker is in your foot. Or you broke a piece of glass in the kitchen, you get one little slither of glass and you can't see it. Oh, you can feel it a little bit, but you can't grab it with the tweezers. Have all of y'all been there? I hope y'all are all human. You know what I'm talking about. And it just kills you. And it's just that big. That's how big Mordecai is in Haman's life and relationship. And besides that, he has been asked by the queen to come to his banquets with the king. Nobody else has done that. Oh, the pride. Oh, the pride. Oh, how proudful he is because he is second in command of the Persian Empire. Then in his little old house, Haman just breaks down and has, well, he tells everybody what he has first. Then Haman recounts to him the glory of his riches and the number of his sons and every instance where the king had magnified him and how he had promoted him above the princesses and servants of the kings. Haman also said, "Even Esther the queen, let no one but me come with the king to the banquet which she had prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her with the king." Boy, and he's letting one little Jew bother him, rob his joy so much that he has a pity party. Yet all of this does not satisfy me every time I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Pity, 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 party, party, party. He can't get over it. Do any of y'all have something like that in your life that you just can't get over? Well, today is a good day to get over it. If it's not worth spending your time on, don't worry about it. You know, I think this thing of what we call obsessive compulsive or disorder, I don't think it's a new order. I think everybody's got it in some form or fashion. I do. And whatever it is that you just are obsessive about is your thorn in the flesh that you have to deal with. So what does Haman's wife say? Verse 14. Then Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends said to him, "We got an idea. Have a gallows 50 cubits high made in the morning and ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go joyfully with the king to the banquet." In other words, that 50 cubits is 75 feet, folks. That's a tall, the height of our new auditorium is only 50 feet outside to the very top, okay, out to the top of the, it's only 50 feet from the ground. So you got to add 25 feet to that. What that meant was, go to the top of the wall that is attached to our house here at the palace of the king and have erected a pole that goes out over the top of it with a noose so that you can put that noose around Mordecai's neck and throw him off the wall and he will hang up there 75 feet in the air so everybody can see it. And then go to have your party with Esther and the king. Well. And the advice pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. He got up and had the gallows. Yeah, they made that little pole that goes out there and tied it off with the rope. And in the morning, he's going to go and he's going to see King Xerxes and tell him about Mordecai, and he's going to get permission to hang Mordecai. Why didn't he handle Mordecai in the first place like this? Why didn't he have to be afraid of Mordecai and decide that he would just eliminate all of Mordecai's people, including Mordecai and all the Jews, with the edict? Why doesn't Haman just wait? I mean, we're already down to the end of the first month. It's just going to be 10 and a half more months. If he can put up with Mordecai that long, surely, you know, all the Jews will be... No, he's got it. He's got to do something about it right now. Just right now. Do you ever just have to do something right now? And after you right now, you find out you were right wrong. You moved too fast. You didn't let God move. You got to do it right now. Not now. If something stirs up in you like that, well, you've got to do it right now. My advice to you is wait. Wait till tomorrow to see how you feel tomorrow about it. Because the gallows you build today may be where you swing tomorrow. If you do today what you want to do today. And by the way, that is the ultimate. You want to bring it back down home? The down home is, oh, we got a little extra money. I got to go spend it. And I got to spend it today. What are you going shopping for? I don't know. I don't need anything, but I want to go spend it today. Just got to go today. It's burning a hole in my pocket. That's exactly right. I got to have it today. And you all have heard my favorite. I hear it every year, several times, right after tax season. Somebody calls me and says, oh, the devil's attacking me. I say, what? The devil's attacking me. What's he doing? The transmission has gone out. It's always a transmission. That's what it is. The transmission has gone out of my car, and I just got my tax refund, and the devil's attacking me because it's going to take exactly the amount of money I got on my tax return to fix my transmission. The devil's just doing it. He's just all over me, and I'm going, whoa, wait a minute. I think God knew that your transmission was going to go out ahead of time, and God provided you with the money to pay for the transmission. Oh, but there's so many other things that I want to buy. Like what? Well, I don't know, but I just want to buy some. That's what I hear. Right now. Gotta, right now. I got to have it right now. We got to go. Wait. Wait. Chapter 6, verse 1. Remember I told you there's bad chapter breaks in Esther? Because it's really a story. There's no good place to stop in Esther. We need to just read on. Because something happens after that gallows is made and he's ready to go in to see Xerxes the next morning. Something happens in the middle of the night. And during the night, the king could not sleep. So he gave orders to bring the book of records, the chronicles, and they were read before the king. Okay, let me just help you here. Remember, Mordecai had told Esther about those two guys that were going to try to kill the king. And the king had that all recorded in the record book. And the king, in next week's lesson, you're going to have to come back. Here's the cliffhanger. King is listening and he's reading. That guy's reading what was written in the chronicles for Xerxes and had happened in his last 30 to 40 to 60 to 90 days. And they come along to the name of Mordecai, how Mordecai had saved the life of the king. It had been written in the chronicles of the king. And lo and behold, the king had not done anything to reward Mordecai. And as soon as the sun comes up, the king has got a plan to reward Mordecai. And somebody's walking through the door to ask if they can have Mordecai hung. And lo and behold, the king has more important business to handle than what Mr. Haman wants to handle first. And the king gets to talk first. And that's where we pick up next week when you come with chapter 6 and chapter 7.